revoked the day before his arrest. So this sparked what we can safely call the largest street protest in Turkey in over a decade across the country. And they were defying a four-day protest ban that the government enforced. They enforced a protest ban. And of course, we saw riot police with tear gas and pepper spray and all that. And you mentioned the mass detentions. But so the point is, many analysts, including those who work with us here at The Cradle, see this as a political purge, you know, of mm-hmm. course, not a legal process. You know, it's an attempt by him to remove his strongest political rival, I guess, you know, ahead of the election. Because this guy is not, he's more than a mayor. He's like a national symbol of political hope for many Turks.
When he's elected for Istanbul mayor, he defeats Erdogan's candidate, right? The CHP defeats the AKP candidate by like 20,000 votes. And some backroom maneuvering by the governing party in Turkey, which, by the way, Erdogan has been president for 23 years in Turkey. They rerun the election, right? They do it again. And then the second time, he wins by almost 1 million votes, right? So if anything, this sort of persecution works in his favor. And I would imagine down the line, it's probably going to continue to work in his favor after what happened last week. What I want to bring up to attention, right, is the parallels of what happened, what Erdogan has done over the past week with İmamoğlu, with what happened with Imran Khan in Pakistan, right? When this very popular prime minister is removed from office in a legislative coup, sent to prison, given dozens of charges on everything, right? Just buried in legal cases, him and his wife thrown in jail. His party is persecuted. His followers are persecuted. It becomes a war, right? In Turkey, it becomes a war against the PTI, if I'm not mistaken. That's Khan's party. In Turkey, it seems to be the same a playbook in a way, and you know, because that's the empire playbook, right? This is what happens. This is what lawfare is. This is how you persecute leaders when you don't want to go into a country with marching, you know, with troops, or you don't have an ISIS, or you don't have, you know, you don't want to launch airstrikes and start killing people. You use lawfare. That's what happened in Brazil. That's what happened in Ecuador. That's what happened in Argentina. That's what happened in Pakistan. That's what happens, you know, everywhere. It's been happening everywhere for many, many years. And it's just I think again this idea that Erdogan is their guy, right? He's the guy. He's the guy who brought down Assad. He's the guy who's friendly with Israel. Who's friendly with Azerbaijan. He's the one that is wanting to kind of combat Iranian influence, right? He wants Turkish influence in West Asia, you know, to overtake whatever is left of Iranian influence. And here's actually what's interesting and what I wanna hear your guys' thought about it, because Walla News, this Israeli news outlet, a few days ago comes out with this incredibly interesting report that says that Israeli officials are talking about a confrontation between Turkey and Israel in Syria being inevitable, and that there's preparations going, right, to essentially be a war between Israel and Turkey, which, by the way, you know, Israel and Turkey, they're allies. They've been allied for the longest time. Erdogan and Netanyahu, you know, two peas in a pod. Erdogan will give the loudest speeches about Netanyahu being a Nazi and a Hitler and whatever else. But then there's actually no attempts to break relations, to cut the gas that flows through Turkish pipelines to Israel, to end a trade. Remember when he poses the trade ban and then immediately a few days later starts giving waivers for companies to continue doing trade with Israel. And we have reports at The Cradle about how the trade has essentially not slowed down. If anything, it has increased since the start of the genocide in Gaza. So do you guys think there's any validity, right? Because let's just remember that Israel has been essentially one of the only countries in the world that has been referring to the Syrian government, the current de facto government in Syria, as an al-Qaeda government, as a terrorist government. And they say, too, that they are supported by Turkey, which is, yes, factually, it is. They're completely supported by Turkey. They are, you know, propped up by Erdogan. Is Israel going to go to war with Turkey in Syria?
Not war. I mean, there may be a Turkish threat.
On social media, they will fight on social media.
100%. Remember yesterday what I posted about the Channel 12 correspondent, that he was saying that this is like just a distraction, basically, like Netanyahu has directed the Israeli media to make it seem like Israel's gearing up for a war with Turkey. And this is to distract from, you know, all the internal crises and to be able to continue maybe, you know, everything else that he's doing. So we have a feature. We'll put it up on the screen, by Mohammad Hassan Sweidan from a few days ago, called The Battle Between Greater Israel and Neo-Ottomanism in Syria. So it gives a perspective on the kind of clashing interests between Israel and Turkey in Syria. But, I mean, even through this analysis, a war does not seem likely at all. Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, just maybe people will not understand how is that. You know, how they are they are talking like this, and there's like institutions who are saying that it's the war is coming between the two. If you read Egyptian or Jordanian newspapers, you will think that the King of Jordan tomorrow will go and like behead Netanyahu, and that al-Sisi will go and like drown the whole Israeli population.
I hope
but
you replace the picture of King Abdullah with the gun. He's cosplaying.
Yeah. So that's it. The media and what these politicians talk is very different of what's happening on the ground. Not only Sisi. Before Sisi, we had Morsi, and before Morsi, we had Hosni Mubarak. Especially during Hosni Mubarak, there was, I think, four wars between, or not wars, we can say four aggressions from Israel on Gaza. And in the four wars, Hosni Mubarak refused to open the borders or to accept even people to like get medical care in Egypt. And Sisi, it's the same. And Sisi is more smart, I think, because Sisi blamed Israel. He said, oh, look, we wanted to take them, but Israel didn't open the border. Although everybody knows that that Egypt has the authority over Gaza. It's like signed. There's a signed agreement that they have the authority. They can take people in and like open the border, but he didn't. So it's the same.
I just one idea about Israel and Turkey that like maybe this will put things into perspective is, you know, Israel, when there is an existential threat to Israel, Israel will set out to destroy its enemies. In the case of Turkey, there will be no war because there is no existential threat from Turkey. There's competition, and there is like, oh, they might be jeopardizing the current Israel wants its regional dominance to look like, because Israel wants total dominance over the region.
To go back to the beginning of the discussion, right? At this point, Israel has reopened three fronts. They have opened the front again in Gaza, the front in Lebanon, and the front in Yemen, right? Even though the front in Yemen is not being fought directly by Israel yet, it's being just fought by the United States. Before we finish for this week, I just want to get your thoughts on like, what is next for Yemen? What can Yemen do next that they haven't done already, right? Because they have already, since the expansion of this war, they have been targeting the U.S. warships, the USS Truman. They have declared Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv unsafe for travel. They say they were going to continue to launch attacks. They've launched, if I'm not mistaken, at least two Palestine 2 missiles, the hypersonic ballistic missiles towards Israel. Both of them, I believe, shot down. But they're on. At this point, they're on their own, right? I heard also that one of their missiles, the fire actually fell in Saudi Arabia. So, what is next? What is next for Yemen?
As I said last time, Esteban, I think, and people got angry in the comments because I said it, but I think unless they take footage from a drone or whatever, or a footage is leaked that they targeted a U.S. ship, okay, as if nothing is happening in the Red Sea. We only hear the news. And you too. You see that the Yemeni says that we targeted this ship, and then the Americans will have a counter post on Twitter say that they downed the drones or the ships or the cruise missiles. Unless there's visual evidence that this is happening, I think that's it, as if they are doing nothing in the Red Sea. But of course, they are... some of course of the Israeli shipping companies are in pain because they are really targeting them.
And to your point, Karim, about we need footage. I think the biggest victories that Yemen achieved since the start of the genocide in Gaza were, first of all, the taking of the Galaxy Leader, right? This action movie footage of them landing on the ship, incredible stuff. And the other one was the drone that Sima made reference to, which again also had the footage, the social media video of the drone flying in from the beach in Tel Aviv, completely unopposed. So I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, because I think the title of last week's videos was very appropriate, the the unfinished wars, because this is really, like, all of this is just going to continue. I know some of it is falling out of the news cycle. We haven't even discussed about the persecution that, anti-genocide protesters are facing in the U.S., in Europe, in other Western nations, the deportations, etc. We haven't talked about Mahmoud Khalil. So many things happening right now, and they're all the repercussion of what? Of allowing a rogue state to continue committing a genocide under the noses of the entire world.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tough talk and threats aside, the Zionist regime finds itself in a more vulnerable position than at any point in its history. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "It is clear that Israel is now using the Arabs to mask its own vulnerabilities. And though the monkey continues to climb, his tail has never been as exposed as it is today. The higher the monkey climbs, the more he shows his tail," warns a timeless Chinese proverb. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, however, seems to neither heed the lessons of history nor the wisdom of such folk sayings. While leading a vilification campaign against Egypt, the Zionist regime leader is further exposing his regime's vulnerabilities. This is yet another example of Israel's inability to alter the political reality in Gaza, 17 months after it launched its devastating war on the Gaza Strip. By targeting Egypt, the Zionist regime aims to project an image of prowess and that it is unafraid to confront the most populous Arab nation. Yet, in doing so, it inadvertently exposes its own weaknesses. This behavior is wholly consistent with Netanyahu's legacy of running a way forward. Long before October 7, 2023, war, Netanyahu was riding a wave of political euphoria. At the time, his relentless climb to greater heights seemed justified. His global South diplomacy was reversing decades of Israeli isolation, and his success in gaining international recognition without paying a significant political price earned him immense popularity at home. In Israel, Netanyahu kept winning one election after another. His latest right-wing extremist coalition secured a comfortable majority in the Knesset facing little pushback. The extremists were poised to transform Israel from within, reconfigure the region, and, with the usual unconditional support from the United States, position the Israeli regime as a global power commanding respect and authority. However, October 7, and the Zionist regime's catastrophic failure on all fronts, exposed Netanyahu's tale as a failed leader. The crisis quickly manifested in global outrage as Israel carried out a genocidal war on the Palestinians, killing and wounding over 160,000 people in the course of 15 months. The Zionist regime's tale was further exposed as the once confident leader who tirelessly promised to reshape the West Asia region to fit Israel's agenda became a wanted criminal by the International Criminal Court on November 21st. While his regime faced investigations for the crime of genocide by the International Court of Justice. Yet Netanyahu climbed even higher, doubling down on his approach. He insisted on continuing the war in Gaza, maintaining a military presence in Lebanon, and carrying out frequent and massive bombing campaigns in Syria. Bravado aside, Netanyahu has still failed to achieve any of Israel's stated objectives through the devastating war on Gaza, a war that has also cost Israel unprecedented losses and casualties. Meanwhile, the divisions among the political and military elites are deepening. The latest manifestation of this is the firing of many top military brass and the reordering of the army to align with Netanyahu's political ambitions. The more Israel's vulnerabilities are exposed, the more Netanyahu and his allies intensify their threats, not only against Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria, but also against Egypt. In fact, Egypt, which is not a party to the war and has been one of the three mediators in ceasefire talks, has become the primary target of the Zionist regime's new strategy aimed at ethnically cleansing Gaza's population into the Sinai Desert. But how did this come about? Egypt was hardly a factor in the Israeli regime war on Gaza. Yet, as the war on Gaza dragged on, with no possibility of a total victory, top Israeli regime officials began pointing fingers at Egypt. The idea of taking over the Philadelphia corridor, separating the city of Rafah in southern Gaza from the Egyptian border, was first floated by extremist finance minister Bezalel Smotrich. Others, including Netanyahu himself, soon began parroting the same words. In the media, the language took an even more foreboding turn, with some accusing Egypt of arming the resistance movement Hamas, or of not doing enough to stop the flow of weapons to the Palestinian resistance. When Egypt rejected Israeli regime accusations and refused to accommodate Israel's wish to ethnically cleanse Gaza, Israeli regime leaders began talking of an Egyptian military threat, alleging that Egypt was amassing troops at its border with Israel. The original aim of roping Egypt into Israel's failed war was meant to create a distraction from the battlefield. Eventually, however, the distraction turned into deflection, blaming Egypt for Israel's inability to win the war or to displace the Gaza population. To some extent, Netanyahu has succeeded in making Egypt part of the conversation on Gaza, with U.S. President Donald Trump repeatedly proposing the displacement of Palestinians and the takeover of Gaza. The Zionist regime leader felt that finally he had a clear American commitment to export Israel's problems elsewhere. Even the leader of the Israeli opposition, Yair Lapid, used Egypt to distract from his own failure to mount a serious challenge to Netanyahu's rule. On February 25th, he proposed that Cairo oversee the strip for a number of years at a conference in Washington. while Palestinians, Arabs and others reacted angrily to the Israel-US ethnic cleansing schemes, few paid attention to the fact that, historically, Israel has never sought permission to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. This was as true during the 1948 Nakba as it is today. Putting pressure on Arab countries to concede to the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing plans is the strongest sign yet of Israel's weakness. Tough talk and threats aside, the child killer regime of Israel finds itself in a more vulnerable position than at any point in its history. It is clear that the Zionist regime is now using the Arabs to mask its own vulnerabilities. And though the monkey continues to climb, his tail has never been as exposed as it is today.
Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali baytihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Brothers, sisters, listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Abdullah Al Musawi. We were discussing scholars and specifically their effect on society. When it comes to these scholars, beside Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala having prepared punishment for them, me and you, we have to be aware of them, especially in today's world. When we live in Western countries, we have scholars in these Western countries. We have those who represent the school of thought of the Ahlul Bayt, the school of thought of the Sunnis, whatever. These systems, this is a fact that needs to be understood and grasped. These systems that we live under in the West, the Western system, the Western ideology, it's a kafir system, is a non-believing system, which is based on the denial of the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One. Two, these systems' main objectives is to fight the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to fight Islam and Muslims. And this is a fact that no one can deny, that America and its allies, their main objective is to fight Muslims and Islam and kill as much of them as possible, or at least change and wipe out their ideology as much as possible. Now, here is a problem. The scholars that live in the West, that attend the masajid, that preach and teach to people and pray and lead processions and what have you, when these ones, these so-called scholars, when they go and side with governments and they shake hand with kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers and council members and member of states and statesmen and congressmen, then we have a problem. Because if that scholar himself goes to these people and it tries to give us this hunky-dory Islam, this roses and rainbows Islam, then obviously we have a problem. When we shake hands with the devil, we have a problem. In the White House, we have a problem. When I see the scholar shaking hands and trying to support and rally support for a candidate for the United States elections, then I have a problem. When I have a scholar walking in the palace and shaking hands with the King of England, then we have a problem. And obviously the list goes on and goes on. So these people, when they do these actions, they try to convince their followers and the people that Islam is a religion of peace and love, and therefore we have no issues with these systems. Now, this is what corruption looks like in its true form. Let me take a break, and then we'll come back together.
Ayatollah Javadi Amiri, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatih al-Hayat. So we said that when the scholars walk into the palaces and castles and houses or whatever they want to call them these days, parliaments of the elite politicians and people in power, then we have to fear for our faith from these people. A hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. He says, mal'oonun mal'oon, cursed, cursed. Alimun ya ummu sultanan jaira, a scholar who goes to an oppressor and sides with him. Mu'inan lahu ala jawra, when he sides with him, what these scholars are doing is that they are justifying their oppression. So when we have scholars in the United States who are walking to the White House, shaking hands with the kings and whatever, we have a problem. They are supporting them in their genocide, in their oppression. When we have scholars walking and shaking hands with the King of England, they are supporting their oppression and genocide towards Muslims. Who is massacred and killed hundreds of thousands of innocent children, men and women, in Gaza and Palestine in this year and last year? Wasn't it the Americans, wasn't Europe, wasn't England, and their undivided attention and undivided support to Israel? Who was supporting Israel? If it wasn't for these countries supporting Israel, Israel wouldn't last 2 minutes. But the entire European and the American and the English system was at their support. Yet, you see, our scholars, I've seen one of them, black turban, old man, white beard, spent all his life in preaching Islam. He says, I will give my blood defending this country, America. Now, I don't know what to say. I honestly, sometimes I'm out of words. But at least the words of the Imam, alayhim salam, are here. Mal'oon and mal'oon, cursed, cursed these people, because they help these people become more oppressors, but under an Islamic theme. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, he says, the worst of evil, the most evil of evil, are the evil of ulama. It's simple as that. وَأَنَّ خَيْرُ الْخِيَارَ خَيَارُ الْعُلَمَاء. And the best of ulama are the best of the ulama. So even when we talk about ranking, sometimes you have a bad scholar, and sometimes you have extremely bad scholar. So sometimes a person, like, he puts himself in a scholarly position, and he does a few things wrong here and there. He says wrong things, and he might have a problem with his community, and what have you. And sometimes you have, no, someone that goes way beyond that, and he sides with the taghut, he sides with the oppressors. And this is what the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, they are warning us about. So we have to be very careful. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Sudan conflict continues to devastate the nation, drawing global attention, with the Sudanese government accusing the UAE of supporting RSF rebels. The stakes have never been higher. Now, as we approach the third year of this conflict, we ask, what lies ahead for Sudan? The military intervention of the United States in Somalia began in 1992. Fast forward to today, and we see ongoing involvement, including recent airstrikes from the Trump administration. While the U.S. asserts that it's battling terrorism, the reality is that terrorists still roam the country unchecked. So, what is the true objective of the U.S. military intervention in Somalia? And to discuss how the U.S. is meddling in Somalia, we have contacted Abdul Latif Ahmed. He is a journalist, research lead, and a digital news editor. And for more on the devastating war in Sudan, we are joined by Meki El-Moghrabi. He is an African affairs analyst and a former diplomat. Stay with us for this week's edition of Africa Today. The Sudan conflict, which erupted in April 2023, continues to devastate the nation, drawing global attention. The war pitted the Sudanese armed forces against the rebel Rapid Support Forces, RSF, now designated a terrorist organization by the Sudanese government. Sudan accuses external actors, particularly the United Arab Emirates, of fueling the conflict by supporting RSF leader Mohamed Dagalo. Now, this involvement has further prolonged the violence, deepening the crisis. The humanitarian toll is staggering. Over 30 million people urgently need aid, with 15 million displaced. Women and children bear the brunt, facing heightened risks of violence, malnutrition, and exploitation. The destruction of critical infrastructure has left education in ruins, while famine spreads across the country. The future of Sudan is uncertain. Where is Sudan headed as the conflict nears its third year?
Sudan's proxy war.
The Sudanese army remains resolute in ending the war. Recently, the army seized full control of the presidential palace in downtown Khartoum in what is seen as a major gain in a two-year-old conflict with the RSF rebels. The military spokesman speaks here after the victory.
Our forces today crowned their successes in the capital, where they were able to crush the terrorists in the areas of the center of the city, the Arab market, the buildings of the presidential palace, the symbol of the sovereignty, pride and dignity of the Sudanese people.
Sudan's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Al-Harith Idris, recently stated that the war in Sudan will not stop unless the United Arab Emirates halts its support for the RSF rebels or terrorists. He said the UAE is shedding the blood of the Sudanese people and killing them with the aim of controlling Sudan's wealth and resources. Now, Mr. El Moghrabi, is this sentiment shared by most people in Sudan?
Yes, it's true. And by the way, this is the stand of Sudanese people. What is said by Ambassador of Sudan in the United Nations represents all the Sudanese people. And all the people are waiting for the Sudanese representative all around the world to say the same. And I believe now there is a room for diplomatic talks and negotiation between United Arab Emirates, but they are losing time and they are creating some fake news media websites and social media accounts, and they want to portray for the people that other Sudanese are saying different things from what is said by the ambassador of Sudan in the United Nations or by the Sudanese people, and that will not work. The Sudanese people now, all of them together, are united against the aggression of United Arab Emirates.
Last February, the Arab League voiced strong opposition to any steps that could threaten Sudan's unity or lead to its division. Despite the statement, Arab countries have been criticized by the Sudanese people for not taking enough action to stop UAE support for RSF rebels.
The majority in the Arab League, the countries are against the United Arab Emirates aggression on Sudan, against the parallel government that is created by United Arab Emirates. By the way, it is not something real up to now, the what so-called parallel government. They couldn't make it. There is pressures on Kenya not to do it. Until now, it is not declared in Kenya. And they want to make it as something real, and it should happen. And but now in the region, Uganda against that, Djibouti against that, Somalia against that, Ethiopia against that, Eritrea against that. Chad now started to negotiate with Port Sudan, and they want to stand against the RSF. They want to change their position, by the way, the Chadian government. And that because of the insecurity that started to happen in Chad, based on the soldiers that they flee the war in Sudan from RSF, and they want to create their own militia inside Chad. Anyway, the Arab League and the other organizations will not accept, will not recognize the what so-called parallel government.
Recent reports indicate that the United States and the Israeli regime have approached Sudan, along with Somalia and Somaliland, to discuss the possibility of resettling displaced Palestinians from Gaza. This proposal has sparked significant controversy and backlash. Why is the Trump administration toying with this dangerous idea of forcefully moving Palestinians out of Gaza to Sudan amid a deadly conflict in this country?
The Sudanese Minister of Foreign Affairs, he said that we didn't receive offer from Israel regarding hosting people from Gaza inside Sudan. The Sudanese position is against dismantling the Palestinian issue or the Palestinian country and the Palestinian nation by taking them outside their lands, and that is has been said firmly by the Sudanese Minister of Foreign, and he he said that we didn't receive the offer. It's just something on the media. Maybe that's just they want to start discussing this with Sudan. They want to make pressures. But I think the Arab stand and the Islamic stand is against such a step.
The humanitarian situation in Sudan will be catastrophic if peace is not attained. Efforts to resolve the Sudan conflict through negotiation have faced significant challenges, and the people continue to suffer. The prospects for peace in Sudan remain challenging, but not entirely out of reach. So is there hope that the conflict approaching its third year will end soon?
Yes, it is very bad situation. Homes, their houses are rocked, and no electricity, no water. But the public opinion saying that we go there, whatever happened. Sudan is not a cold country. By the time of Eid, it will not be winter in Sudan. And it will be part of the summer, so that people can manage their lives. And we lived part of our lives with water shortage and energy shortage, and we know how to manage that by local solutions. So that people of Sudan and people of Khartoum are back, and they will go to their homes and. They will not stop the life. And yes, we need support from friends, but this support, if it has a political condition, we will not accept.
Well, thank you very much, Meki El Moghrabi, for your insight. Indeed, we look forward to the restoration of peace and prosperity in Sudan. Stay with us for the next segment of our program on how Trump is meddling in Somalia.
Trump meddling in Somalia.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. military intervention in Somalia, initiated in 1992, continues under the pretext of war on terror. Recent airstrikes during the Trump administration have faced criticism for causing civilian casualties. Critics argue that these actions exacerbate instability, allowing terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab to thrive. At the same time, influential Republicans, including Congressman Scott Perry, are advocating for U.S. recognition of Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland. Now, this aligns with Project 2025, a roadmap prepared for implementation during the Trump presidency. Such a move raises concerns about U.S. intentions to balkanize Somalia, potentially using Somaliland as a counterbalance to diminishing influence in neighboring Djibouti, where China's presence is growing. Meanwhile, African Union troops in Somalia lack the resources to effectively combat terrorism and restore security, creating a pretext for the prolonged U.S. presence. Now, in a startling development, reports suggest that the U.S. and the Israeli regime plan to relocate Palestinians from Gaza to Somalia and its breakaway region of Somaliland. Now, this raises a critical question. Is the U.S. genuinely fighting terrorism in Somalia, or are there hidden motives behind its involvement? The U.S. Africa Command conducts numerous military operations across the continent targeting alleged terrorist groups. Yet, despite these operations, terrorism is on the rise in Africa, and countless innocent civilians are losing their lives due to these U.S. actions. The so-called war on terror by the U.S. in Somalia has been going on for decades, but terrorists still roam freely in the country. Mr. Ahmad, what exactly is the U.S. military doing in Somalia?
The U.S.'s presence in Somalia is merely a pretext because the involvement of the United States has spanned over three decades, and it has little to do with terrorism, the fight against terrorism, as the case may be. What we have seen over time is an attempt at geopolitical dominance in the Horn of Africa, and Somalia's strategic position along the Gulf of Aden is offers it as a critical global shipping route, and the United States' presence there is essentially to be present to, you know, under the guise of counterterrorism, to basically deploy its drone, its military operations, to ensure that, you know, the U.S. has a strategic hold on that region.
Key Republican figures like Congressman Scott Perry are urging official U.S. recognition of Somaliland, a self-governing region of Somalia, as part of the Conservative Project 2025 agenda for a potential future Trump administration. The Heritage Foundation-led strategy singles out Somaliland and Djibouti in its African policy, implying recognition could counterbalance America's reliance on Djibouti, home to its sole permanent military base in Africa. It raises concerns that the so-called war on terror is merely a pretext, suggesting that the Trump administration may have plans to balkanize Somalia.
The push by the U.S. Republicans to formally recognize Somaliland is a clear indication that Americans' interest is not about stability but strategic fragmentation. Divide and conquer, the more you have smaller units to interact with, the easier for you. So, you know, by endorsing the Somaliland, there's a tendency that the U.S. is employing the same divide and rule tactics of Western powers, historically weaken African nations. What you would also notice is that by recognizing Somaliland, which is generally more peaceful as compared to Somalia, it will serve as a counterweight against China's presence and influence in neighboring Djibouti. Beijing has established a significant military presence in Djibouti and economic presence.
African Union troops have been deployed in Somalia to combat the rise of terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab. Now, their success hinges on support from other African nations and also the United Nations. However, the military capabilities of the African Union mission are limited, providing a rationale for continued U.S. military presence in Somalia. Now, is the weakening of African Union forces in Somalia a deliberate strategy?
There's no doubt that the underperformance of AMISOM benefits the United States and any other external body because it creates a justification for Washington to maintain a military foothold in Somalia. You would realize that African-led peacekeeping efforts are being intentionally underfunded and undermined because it ensures that Somalia remains perpetually reliant on external military assistance. And a stronger AMISOM will definitely, you know, backed by genuine African cooperation and support from the AU and African state, will render U.S. intervention unnecessary. U.S. will not be needed, you know, on African soil. But what you realize is that this does not align with the long-term agenda of the United States, which thrives on the instability and dependency. So African nations must figure a way to get real security, to ensure that Somalia is able to stand on its own, have its real security, and is able to achieve this through self-sufficiency and, you know, regional solidarity.
The federal government of Somalia has categorically rejected reports that it is holding talks with the United States and the Israeli regime Israel on forcefully moving Palestinians from their land in Gaza to Somalia. Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland has also denied holding talks on the same issue. A Somali politician says the country will not be accepted.
As an independent politician, Somali politician, I don't think that we'll get the unanimous support of the Somali people, be it people, I mean the population or the government.
The fact that such a report on ejecting Palestinians from their land and moving them to Somalia has leaked indicates that there is more than meets the eye in America's military presence in Somalia. Now, what do you make of this dangerous plan?
The leaked reports on the alleged U.S. and Israel's plan to resettle displaced Palestinians in Somalia raises serious concerns, you know, about America's broader agenda in the region. While the Somaliland and Somali federal government has denied these reports, there's a chance that there are underhand dealings, there are backdoor dealings to ensure that this happens. It indicates that there's an attempt to undermine Somaliland and Somalia. There's also an attempt to disregard Palestinians because they have insisted to not be resettled elsewhere.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up, but we shall keep you posted on U.S. plans aimed at destabilizing Somalia and other African countries. I would like to thank Abdulatif Ahmed for his incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. From me, Mubarak Kenya, and the entire crew, it's goodbye for now.
The limelight.
During the 1948 war, Zionist regime forces committed more than 30 documented massacres in Palestine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "It is important to know the origins of the Israeli lobby to realize the significant sway it has had on American politics and the politicians. For that, we have to go back in time to post-World War II history to begin to correct the injustices that generations of Palestinians have faced and to become a society that can live with its conscience. The story of Palestine and its people must be told." After the Second World War, the United States made the decision to tie its destiny to the ethno-nationalist settler colonial regime of Israel. And since then, the Palestinian people have stood alone in their struggle. The establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel was a violent process that has never ended. Beginning in 1947, Zionist paramilitary forces launched large-scale attacks on Palestinian towns and villages, leading ultimately to the Nakba, the catastrophe, the culminating stage of the Zionist ethnic cleansing project. During the Nakba, 531 Palestinian towns and villages were destroyed. 15,000 Palestinians were murdered. 800,000 were forcibly driven from their homeland to the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and to neighboring Arab countries, and 70 massacres were committed. Before Israel's declaration of statehood on May 14, 1948, Zionist militias had committed numerous massacres whose histories have largely been suppressed. Baldat al-Sheikh, on December 31st, in 1947, 70 Palestinians massacred. Sa'sa, on February 14th, in 1948, 16 houses and their inhabitants blown up. Deir Yassin, on April 9th, in 1948, 107 were killed, including scores of children, women and elders. Some victims were found maimed, raped, and then killed. Masses of men were put on trucks and paraded across Al-Quds before being taken to a quarry to be executed. These atrocities were committed by Irgun and Stern gangs led by Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, respectively, who would later become prime ministers of the fabricated regime of Israel. And Abu Shusha on May 13th, in 1948. Despite efforts of residents to protect their homes, the village fell to occupation. 60 Palestinians massacred. During the 1948 war, Zionist regime forces committed more than 30 documented massacres in Palestine. Israeli regime military historian Yuri Milstein has suggested that there were more than 100. In ensuing years, Israel continued its campaigns of forced displacement and massacres. Notably, it was Gibeah massacre of October 14, 1953, that gave birth to what would become the most powerful pro-Israel lobby in the United States. Born in the blood of the natives of Palestine, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, has spared no efforts to ensure that Israel's ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians be kept hidden from the American people. It is important to know the origins of the Israeli lobby to realize the significant sway it has had on American politics and politicians. For that, we have to go back in time to post-World War II history. Harry S. Truman is president of the United States regime and running for re-election with few prospects and little support until the Israeli lobby literally enters the campaign in the person of Abraham Feinberg, a hosiery manufacturing magnate. And the rest, as they say, is history, Israeli history. The man who made Truman's 1948 election victory possible explained how it was done in an interview conducted in 1973 for the Harry S. Truman Library. Oral history interview with Abraham Feinberg. He stated in the interview that without Truman, Israel would have had very difficult days and times trying to even come into existence. Israel's American enforcers faced challenges during the Eisenhower years from an administration inclined toward a more nuanced policy. During the president's first year in office, news of the massacre in the Palestinian village of Gibeah sparked widespread disapproval. Time magazine, for example, carried the story describing how Israeli regime troops shot every man, woman, and child they could find, then turned their fire on the cattle, reporting also that soldiers were seen slouching in the doorways of Palestinian homes, smoking and joking. 66 people were killed that night, 45 were blown up in their homes that had been dynamited by soldiers. The New York Times ran excerpts from the United Nations Mixed Armistice Commission in charge of the 1949 truce, deploring the act as cold-blooded murder and refuting Israeli lies about the assault. Israel's defenders quickly gathered for damage control. Isaiah L. Kennan, founder of the American Zionist Committee for Public Affairs, AZCPA, the forerunner of AIPAC, wrote of the ill effect it would have on what he called our propaganda. To manage the Libya fallout and to prepare for future